Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
Hello, I'm Ashley.
And this is Monstrous.
Welcome, guys.
We're back with part two of the Velisca murders. And today's episode, we're going to cover the suspects and the haunting that is said to be associated with this house. So, throughout the investigation, several suspects had emerged. Many came immediately following the murders, but in the end, no one had ever been convicted. There was no shortage of suspects. Like, literally, pretty much anyone that had no alibi, they were a suspect. So, in the days that followed the murders, anyone could pick up a newspaper and read all about several of the suspects in the case. Many of the leads that investigators got were quickly worked and cleared, and as time went on, the leads they received began to dwindle until they stopped altogether. Although no one was ever convicted of the murders, and it is still an unsolved case, one suspect was taken to trial, and he was taken to trial not once, but twice.
Which one was taken twice?
I'm getting ready to tell you. So allegedly, Reverend George Kelly, who had left town the morning following the murders, so he left town the morning the family was discovered. Allegedly, he had told passengers on the train with him that there were 8 dead souls in the town who had been butchered in their beds, and the victims had not yet been discovered at that point.
And that's not suspicious at all.
Right? A few months after the murders, the Reverend had actually signed a confession saying that God had come to him and whispered to, quote, suffer the children to come unto me. So, after looking into him, hearing the rumors, all of that, he was arrested and he was taken to trial. And even though he had made this confession, during his September trial, he recanted it, saying, oh no, I just said that. Which, false confessions do happen. They happen all the time. It's not unheard of, as more and more cases, especially of those that are on death row, are being re-looked at. It's being shown many people confess to crimes they didn't commit. Especially, like, back then, before, really, you had rights. Like, you had rights, but they weren't, like, enforced, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
So, in this trial, the jury deadlocked. 11-1. Do you think they were going to find him guilty, or do you think they were going to acquit him? The jury deadlocked 11-1 for acquittal. So 11 people thought he was innocent. Yep. So the trial ended up in a mistrial. His second trial then took place in November. What do you think the outcome of this trial was?
Who knows?
The jury found him not guilty of all 8 murders.
He told people on the train.
Yep. After his suspicious leaving, everything he said, his confession, all of it.
Guilty.
Yep. They found him not guilty. And that's it. That is where the case really ends. Reverend George Kelly was the only person to ever be taken to trial for the murders. Oh, yeah, probably. Oh, yeah. Because we know reverends tend to do a lot of not so godly things. So, like I said, even though he was the only one to go to trial, there were a surplus of suspects in the case. So even after the investigation, they continued to receive tips and even confessions, including a confession from a prisoner in 1931 out of Detroit who had claimed that an unknown businessman had offered him $5,000 to kill the Moore family. So even decades later, they're still getting tips and confessions in. Authorities had chased down multiple leads in the years following the murders, going as far as to send bloodhounds to Nebraska in an attempt to hunt down a suspect. In the end, though, each lead led to a dead end, leaving no justice served in this case. And sadly, these 8 lives were not the only ones lost due to this tragedy. Lena and Ina's mother was also pregnant at the time of the murders of her children. And as a result of her tragic loss, she miscarried her unborn child.
The mother was pregnant when she was murdered.
No, so that's kind of confusing. I didn't clarify. Okay, so Lena and Ina were the two little neighbor girls that spent the night with the Moore family. Their mother was pregnant when her daughters were killed. Yeah, and because of the loss that she suffered, and obviously the stress and the pain and the grieving that comes with that, she also miscarried her unborn child.
Yeah.
So in the wake of all this, she lost 3 children. And there was never anyone tried and found guilty for any of them.
And that would suck, you know, not having justice.
Oh, yeah. Living the rest of your life not having any idea what happened.
Yeah.
I could not. I don't know how I could go on in life. I really don't. So, as of today, historians and many others that have studied the murders seem to have come up with 3 prime suspects. And most people that know about the case are in one of these 3 camps for who they believe the killer was. Although they're not the only 3 suspects, they're just the ones most likely to have committed the murders. So these camps include Frank Jones, who was a prominent resident of Villisca. He was Joe Asai's business rival. He was his former boss and then went on to become the Iowa State Senator. So he's got some pull there. Some believe it was Reverend George Kelly, even though he was acquitted. While others believe the murder was committed by someone completely unrelated to the town, possibly being a traveler, a homeless man, or a serial killer that moved between states. So, here are each of the suspects that have been discussed and believed to possibly be responsible, and it's very extensive. We're going to get into the background. So first we have William Blackie Mansfield. It is believed by many that he was a hired hitman. So as I mentioned before, Josiah had worked for the Iowa State Senate, Frank Jones, in the past until he decided to leave Frank's shop and open his own company in 1908. According to town residents, Frank was extremely upset that Josiah left and that he had been able to take the lucrative John Deere franchise with him. It was rumored that Josiah had also had an affair with Jones' daughter-in-law, Donna, which caused the anger within Frank to become even stronger. A detective named Wilkerson had openly accused Frank Jones and his son Albert for hiring William to kill Joseph. So this detective was just straight, no, he did it. Didn't care how prominent his family was. Openly accused him. Neither man, though, was ever arrested, and both denied any connection to the murders. However, though, William Mansfield, who was said to be the hired hitman, was arrested in 1916, 4 years after the murders. Detective Wilkerson had believed he was responsible for the axe murders of his own wife, infant child, and both his father and mother-in-law on July 5th of 1914 in Blue Island, Illinois. Wilkerson also suspected that Williams was also responsible for two other axe murders in Payola, Kansas, just 4 days before the Villisca murders, and one in Aurora, Colorado, that had many of the same details as the one he committed in 1914.
So same patterns.
Yep.
Like most serial killers do.
Yep. So in the end, Wilkerson, along with many of his fellow investigators, had concluded that each of the murders were most likely done by the same person because of all the similarities. It was an MO, modus operandi. We'll get to that. You're jumping ahead here. So in each of the murders, the victims were bludgeoned to death with the blunt end of the axe. The mirrors and the bodies were covered, and a lamp with the chimney off was left at each scene, just like the Villisca murders. Wilkerson had even convinced a grand jury to open an investigation into William, which, for anybody that knows, grand jury testimony and proceedings are private. Those aren't ever opened. You can't get in there. You can't see the records. A grand jury is a panel of, it kind of depends on the jurisdiction that you live in, but typically it's 6 to 8 people. They come in, they listen to what evidence they have against this person or persons. They listen to witness testimony, all of that, and they decide, okay, are we going to indict this person or persons? Are we going to, okay, you know, a massive major investigation into this based off of what we have seen? So Wilkerson had enough evidence against William for a grand jury to agree with him, which is not easy to do. So Mansfield was later arrested, but their belief on his connection to the Villisca murders was quickly dashed. Payroll records proved a rock-solid alibi that placed Mansfield in Illinois at the time of not only the Villisca murders, but also the Payola murders in Kansas. And so, he was released. Mansfield then later won a lawsuit against Wilkerson and was awarded $2,225, which in today's money would be $70,835.
Damn.
Yeah. Wilkerson, following this, told newspapers that he fully believed that Jones had pressured for Mansfield to be released and had also pushed for investigators to arrest and try Reverend Kelly instead of Mansfield. And this leads us to Reverend George Kelly. He was the other prime suspect, and in the end, like I said before, the only one ever tried. Kelly was a traveling preacher who was originally born in England. Kelly and his wife had settled in Macedonia, Iowa in 1912 after years of preaching throughout the Midwest. In 1917, Kelly was arrested and charged for the murders of one of the victims, which I don't understand that. 8 people were killed. How do you only charge him for one murder?
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense.
No.
Did it say which one?
No. All of my resources, it just said one of the murder victims. Yeah, it's weird. So the day of the murders, Kelly was about to enter the Presbyterian Seminary and was working at the church that the Moore family and the two Cylinder girls had went to for that children's program. His presence in Villisca the night of the murders and how fast he left town in the early morning hours of June 10th made him the prime suspect. So just the fact that he was this weird guy who just kind of appeared and then left is what made him suspicious. Things got worse for Kelly when he wrote lengthy letters to the investigators and even posed as an investigator for Scotland Yard to get into the house shortly after the murders had taken place.
And that's not suspicious at all.
Right? Like, that's not weird.
Unless if he was, like, a reporter, because some of them, you know.
Well, yeah, because that's their jobs, but, like, he left town and then came back. Yeah, it's weird. He had also sent a bloody shirt to a drugstore to be cleaned the week after the murders.
And back then, they probably couldn't test the blood.
Yeah, they didn't have, like, the DNA and technology and, yeah, like, stuff that we have now. Things. Yeah. So, all they knew is that it was blood. They had no idea whose blood it was. But because of his presence and how he was acting, you know, the rumors that were going around about him, it made it look very suspicious that he sent a blood-covered shirt to be cleaned.
Yeah, no shit.
So, despite the belief that he was involved, they failed to arrest him initially because of one simple reason. His slight build.
His what?
His build. The way he was built.
Okay.
Kelly stood at only 5'2" tall. And only weighed about 119 pounds. So, to put that in reference for you, Kelly stood 2 inches taller than I do. Was built the same way that I am. And weighed about the same as what I weigh. So, now imagine this tiny man doing what was done to these victims. I mean, I haven't been to the Villisca house, which, let me tell you, I'm dying to go. I want to go so bad. So I'm not exactly sure how tall the ceilings were, but with looking at my house and your house and seeing how high our ceilings are, I wouldn't think someone standing at 5'2" could just reach up and touch the ceilings. Or be able to swing an axe back and hit the ceiling hard enough to leave a gash in it.
I mean, it's hard to say without knowing, like, how tall this ceiling is.
Yeah. I mean, stranger things have happened. It's very possible. It's just hard to imagine that is how it happened with him being such a small man. But who knows? Stranger things have happened. That's for sure. So anyway, because of this, the detectives and the coroner felt that he was incapable of committing the crime because of the weight of the axe, because they are heavy, and then the marks that were left behind on the walls and the ceilings, they did not feel that he was tall enough or even strong enough to be able to produce either. But in the end, they did end up charging and arresting him 5 years after the murders had happened. By this time, though, witnesses had a hard time remembering details that they originally told detectives, and the coroner's jury, this along with the lack of evidence, left the first jury hung, ending in a mistrial, and the second ultimately finding him not guilty. Following both trials, Kelly moved from the Midwest to New England. Kelly died in 1959 at the age of 80
And did they say how old he was at the time of the murders?
No. So, let me see. This was 1912. Hang on. I can figure it out. He was 80 in 1959, and the murders took place in 1912, so he would have been 47. So, if you account for his age, and back then, I mean, this is a time where you typically only live to be, like, fucking 50. He's 47. Back then, that's considered to be, you know, old. Plus, he's not a very big man. I find it really hard to believe that he was capable of doing it.
Unless it's like, there was two people, and he was also involved.
I mean, it's possible.
He explained, like, the blood on his shirt and everything else.
Yeah. It's very possible that more than one person was involved. I mean, there were 8 people. But at the same time, children aren't that hard to subdue, though. If you get the parents out of the way first, you know, these are just a bunch of little kids. The oldest was like 12. So it's possible that he did it. He does make a good suspect because he is very suspicious and he just seems creepy. But being creepy and suspicious does not mean that you're a murderer.
You're just a little odd.
Exactly. So anyway, he died in 1959 at the age of 80 in Islip Hospital in upstate New York. This hospital is one of the country's largest and most notorious, wait for it, psychiatric hospitals at the time.
Huh.
Kelly and his wife are buried in Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. Many researchers have dove deep into the theory that Kelly was responsible. Like, he's had the most research done on him because he was the only one taken to trial. So upon these deep dives, they had found that Kelly, although he was intelligent and he was articulate, he also suffered from schizophrenia. Which, that could have been a reason that they believed he was guilty.
Right.
Because back then, if you were mentally ill, it wasn't a mental illness. Something was wrong with you. You were crazy. Or you were possessed. Or, you know, something like that. So that could have been part of it. But it was also found that Kelly had a history of peeping in windows.
That's completely different from, like, a peeping Tom.
Well, see, when I hear peeping in windows, I think it's the same thing. But it doesn't, like, it doesn't clarify. Was he, like, just kind of like, you know, is somebody home kind of looking in windows? Or was he being a creep about it? And being, like, a peeping Tom. Like, nothing, it's not clear. That's all it says. So it could go either way. Either way is a little weird. You come around looking at my windows, we're going to have a problem, my guy. He was known as what they referred to as a firebug.
A what?
A firebug. So he set fires. Which by itself isn't necessarily indicative of if you're a murderer or not.
Right.
Some people just like fire. It was discovered that he had actually confessed in his youth about several arson crimes. There was like a series of arson crimes, I guess, in an area that he lived in when he was younger. And he had eventually confessed to those.
Apparently he just liked fires.
Yeah, I mean, it is weird, coupled with everything else. But there's no like major indicator saying, oh, he is definitely a killer. Like, just because you set fires doesn't mean you're going to kill somebody. So he does make a good suspect. I got to give him that. He's weird. But being a peeping, fire-starting weirdo and being a killer are not the same thing.
Not even close.
So next we have Andy Sawyer. Every homeless person, transient, or other unaccounted for stranger that was in town that night was a suspect. And that included Andy Sawyer. Just like with nearly all the other suspects in the case, there was no real evidence that linked him to the crime. His name came up in several of the grand jury testimonies, and that basically is what made him a suspect. Is he just got brought up. So according to Thomas Dyer, a resident of Burlington, Iowa, Andy had approached his crew in Creston at 6 a.m. on June 10th, the morning that the murders had taken place. He was said to have been clean-shaven, wearing a brown suit when he got there, but his shoes were covered in mud, and his pants were wet near the knees. I have no idea what that has to do with anything. Like, maybe he tripped and fell on his way over there.
Right.
Like, I'm not sure what that has to do with anything, but it's there. So he asked Dyer to employ him because Dyer needed an extra man for his job, which Dyer gave him on the spot. He then went on to testify when the crew had a ride in Fontenelle, Iowa. Sawyer had purchased a newspaper, which he went off on his own to read. Isn't suspicious to me.
No.
He just went to go read a newspaper and didn't feel that he needed an audience to do that.
That's typically like any old person in reality.
Exactly. When I sit down and read a book, I don't want an audience. I go off by myself and read it. Like, but on the front page of the newspaper that Sawyer had purchased was the story of the axe murders. Dyer had also stated that Sawyer was very interested in the case, which so was everybody else. Like, he wasn't the only one.
Yeah, probably a big thing that happened. There's going to be a lot of people that are curious. And, you know, back then, you gotta think, you know, newspaper is probably the biggest way.
Exactly. Like, before the murders took place, the biggest thing was the Titanic sinking, because this happened right after the Titanic sunk. So that was a huge thing. And then all of a sudden, here's an octuple murder in this tiny Iowa town. It was a huge deal. Everybody wanted to know about it. So him being interested in it isn't suspicious to me. According to Dyer, the crew had complained about Sawyer sleeping with his clothes on. Right, like, who cares? But apparently then it was weird, and stated that they had made statements about him being anxious to be by himself. A lot of people don't want to be by themselves. They were also uneasy about the fact that Sawyer slept with his axe.
Maybe he was scared.
I don't know. That one was a little weird to me. Why are you sleeping with an axe, sir? I don't sleep with an axe. No, it's on my nightstand. So he had often talked about the Villisca murders and whether his fellow crew members had believed if they had caught the right killer or not. Which I don't know. That could go either way. Like, the Villisca murders, I'm sure, were the talk of the town during this time. They had a suspect. They had someone in custody. But was it the right person or not? Because, I mean, he was a reverend after all. So, allegedly, Sawyer had told Dyer that he was in Villisca that Sunday night, that he had heard of the murders, and even went on to say that he was afraid he may be a suspect, which was why he had left Villisca that Monday morning.
You know, they have to say that, like, he's afraid he's going to be a suspect, and just him leaving the town in general, obviously, you know, that looks bad.
Yeah. But there's nothing else that I think makes him suspicious.
But why leave out? Why think that?
Exactly. That's the only thing. But it could just be, you know, he was a homeless man. He wasn't from the area. No one really knew him. So it could have just been that he was afraid of being just this random person in town that he would be blamed. So Dyer went to the sheriff once his suspicions had grown. Before the sheriff had arrived, Dyer stated that he had walked behind Sawyer, who was rubbing his head with both hands, and then all of a sudden, Sawyer had jumped up and said to himself, "I will cut your GD head off," at the same time that he made a striking motion with his axe, then started hitting piles of different stuff that was in front of him. So, that's weird. But he could have also had a mental health issue that caused him to act that way. We don't know. Just because you say something like that does not mean you're going to kill somebody. So Dyer's son, Junior, had even testified that one day as the crew was driving through Villisca, Sawyer had told him that he would show him where the man that had killed the Moore family got out of town. Sawyer stated that the killer had jumped over a specific manure box that was located a block from the Moore house and then crossed the railroad track. Then said that the killer had stepped into a creek and pointed at a tree just on the other side of a rail car. So that's weird.
That is weird.
How would you know those details, sir? But in the end, Sawyer was dismissed as a suspect when it was discovered that he could prove he was in Osceola, Iowa, the night of the murder. Here, he had been arrested for vagrancy and the Osceola sheriff stated that he himself put Sawyer on a train around 11 p.m. that night, headed out of town. So, this was either stuff that everyone on the crew had either made up about Sawyer, or he was just running his mouth to get attention.
Why would you want your attention in a fucking case runner, like?
There are still people today that call and say, oh, I know about this, or I committed that murder, or, you know, I know about it, just to get attention. Just to get credit, even though they didn't do it. Happens all the time. Yep. Happens all the time. So then we have Joe Ricks. He was an early suspect in the case. He was a man who had been arrested in Monmouth, Illinois, when he stepped off the train wearing shoes that appeared to be covered in blood. Yep. They arrested this man because he had shoes on that looked like he had blood on them. Yep. Oh, the 1900s. So in newspaper articles, you can find the accusation, but he was not recognized as the man seen in Villisca, who was allegedly asking for directions to the family Moore home before the murders took place. So apparently, this is not listed in any other research that I found. This stuff about the suspects is the only place where this is said. There was a man asking for directions to the Moore home the night of the murders.
Did they say who it was?
Nope. That's all it says, is that he did not match the description of the man asking for directions to the family home. That's it. And I looked, I dug deep, everything that I could find, nothing is out there. Not a name, not a description, nothing.
Weird.
Yeah. So, who knows who it is? So, the next suspect we have is Henry Lee Moore. As early as May of 1913, investigators believe that the Moore murders may be a part of murders committed by a serial killer. M.W. McLaughlin, I might be saying that wrong, who was a federal officer assigned to the case, announced that he had found a suspect in the string of a total of 5 murders. All very similar, all committed around the same time throughout the Midwest. This man, of course, was Henry Lee Moore. He is no relation to the Moore family. He just happens to have the same name. Because I thought, oh gosh, this is like a brother or something. Nope, there's no relation. Moore was just a popular name. So, Henry was born November 1st, 1874 in Boone County, Missouri. He was the oldest of 4 boys. His father was in Enosh, I think is how you say it. He was a Civil War veteran, and his mother was Georgia Ann Wilson Moore, who was a nurse. By 1910, Henry's father and 2 of his brothers had died, and his last remaining brother had moved to California. Throughout his childhood, Henry grew up very troubled. While Henry lived in Missouri, he developed a habit of visiting morgues to look at dead bodies. He kept a scrapbook of famous murder cases. And this was a collection that he started as early as the age of 8 years old. So, it's weird that he went to morgues just to look at dead bodies. That's very odd and kind of concerning. I feel like that would be a discussion we would need to be having. Having scrapbooks of famous murder cases by itself isn't necessarily anything. I mean, we're on a podcast talking about murder right now. So by itself, it does not mean he's a killer. But the fact that he started it around 8 years old, that is concerning. Where was your mother, sir? Like, is this something we need to figure out here? It's very concerning to me. So, the 2 things paired together is a red flag. So, at one point, he worked as a farmhand in his younger years, and it was rumored that he had actually fathered a child with the farmer's daughter, who was underage at that time. So there's another big red flag. Just wave that around. Henry had several run-ins with the law once he had reached adulthood. And in 1910, he was ultimately convicted of forgery and served time in a Kansas state prison. He was released in May of the following year, so 1911. And after his release, the axe murders began to happen. Yes. So the first axe murder that McGoffrey had suspected Henry of happened in Colorado Springs, Colorado, in September of 1911. During this time, Henry had worked on the railroad. A month later, in October, a family in Monmouth, Illinois was murdered, and only a week later, a family of five in Ellsworth, Kansas was murdered in their sleep. And then the week before the Villisca murders, a husband and wife were killed in Payola, Kansas. Each murder, including that in Villisca, all had very striking similarities, and each was located along the railroad. So, if you're keeping count, I only listed four murders, not five. And that is because the last murder happened a lot closer to home for Henry than any of the others. And it happened 5 years after the Villisca murders. In 1917, Henry found himself in love with a 16-year-old girl named Quinny Nichols. Which, I did the math for, okay, he was 43 years old at this time. And was in love with a girl 27 years younger than him, who was underage.
That's a big age gap.
I mean, if she was an adult, it's kind of weird for me, but if she was an adult, like, say, he was 43, she was 18, that'd be really weird, and I would have some concerns, okay? But she's underage. She's 16. You're 43. How are you attracted to a 16-year-old girl?
I mean, it does happen.
It's weird. It's gross. And a major red flag. Like, he's got red flags flying everywhere over here. It's gross. Which back then, like, it wasn't... Like, for us today, we're like, that is disgusting. You're a pedophile. You need to... You know what I mean? But back then, it wasn't like what it is today. It was whatever. But we all know, that's a red flag, guy. So, Quinny had rejected his marriage proposal because he didn't have his own home. Not because of how much older he was. Not because she was a 16-year-old child. Because he didn't have his own home.
So, he's 43 and doesn't have his own home?
Yep.
The state where he was living at?
He lived with his mother. Yep. But, you know, that's a big problem by itself, but I digress. He had assured her that he would soon be the sole owner of his mother's home. Then, on December 17th of 1917, he checked into a hotel in Columbia using an alias. You don't use an alias unless you're up to something. Why do you need to hide that you're in a hotel room?
Because either one, they don't understand, or two, they are obviously up something.
Exactly. An alias is never good. It was believed that he then went to his mother's house, beat her to death with a rusty coal axe while she sat in her chair putting ointment on her hands. He then went upstairs and beat his 82-year-old grandmother to death. Following this, he went back to the hotel, attempted to clean himself up, but he didn't do a good job about it. Instead, he ended up just spreading the blood everywhere. Sheets, clothes, arms, literally everywhere. Then he went back to his mother's to, air quote, discover the bodies. But the blood-covered clothes and the realization that he had spent the night at the hotel made him the prime suspect. Following the investigation, Henry was arrested and ultimately convicted of the double murder on March 14th, 1918, and was sentenced to life in prison.
Yeah.
So in 1925, he was paroled and then later died in 1949 at the age of 82 in a Salvation Army center in St. Louis. McCoffrey believed that Henry was responsible for the 5 murders that had killed a total of 22 people in the Midwest. And he followed this theory for years, even opening an official investigation into his theory. But ultimately, Henry was never charged, convicted, or named as the perpetrator of any murder other than his mother and grandmother's. So this leads us to the final and most recent theory. Researchers today believe that the Villisca murders were a pattern left behind by a serial killer that used the train to travel around selecting his victims. This pattern involved many axe murders that ranged from 1910 to 1919, which points to Henry Moore not being guilty of any of the murders he was not convicted of, because he was incarcerated in 1918, and that was before the murders had stopped. So if the murders continued, it couldn't have been him. Robbery was not a motive in any of the murders, and the murders of his family were clearly greed-driven. So another key signature missing from Henry's crime that was present in all the others was the fact that the victims' faces had been covered, and the fact that his mother and grandmother were beaten to death, while the other murders were committed with, like, a normal, regular axe.
Mother, grandma.
Well, yeah, but then the faces would have been covered, because typically when a victim's face is covered, whoever did it knows the victim. Lastly, the theory involving him doesn't really fit, because the murders started while he was still incarcerated in 1910. He didn't get out of prison until 1911.
Yeah.
And then they stopped after he had already been imprisoned in 1918. So there's no way he committed them. So he could probably be ruled out.
Yeah.
So known crime researcher Beth Killigan-Smith, I believe that's how you say it, had suggested that there were as many as 10 murders that happened close to railways as far as Washington that had the potential to be a part of a serial killer's trail. And each one had very striking similarities to the Villisca case. And Beth isn't the only one that holds that belief. Author Troy Taylor wrote about this in his 2012 book, Murdered in Their Beds. He explored many murders of families in Texas, Colorado, and all throughout the Midwest that seemed to echo the Villisca murders. And in his podcast, American Hauntings, Taylor spoke of another crime that took place in San Antonio. This murder, Taylor believed, was where it all began. But he didn't point to who he believed may be the right suspect for not only the San Antonio murder, but all of them. Then, in 2017, the book The Man on the Train was published. Journalist Bill James and his daughter Rachel James had theorized in their book that the murders may have been the work of Paul Mueller, who was a German immigrant drifter and logger. The father-daughter duo had even been able to tie Paul to the Heinter Kaifax axe murders that took place in Germany in 1922. Believing that Mueller had returned to Germany following 1919 and continued his killings there, which was why they stopped here in the U.S. So between the researchers and these authors, among others, have focused on crimes where families had been murdered by an axe and shared similarities. During this time, for axes were a weapon of convenience because almost every home had one. Some involved young girls yet to hit puberty, but not all homes had mirrors because they were an expensive luxury item back then. But those that did have mirrors had them all covered with some type of cloth or clothing. Most of the victims had their faces covered. The windows and doors were locked, which to us sounds normal, but during this time it wasn't. And lastly, at each scene, there was found a gas lamp with the chimney removed and the wick turned so low it barely burned. So, some of these cases that are cited to have some type of connection to the Villisca murders, it's really based on speculative evidence. Nothing really ties them together. But I think we should mention them. So, first is the Colorado Spring murders of 1912. September 17th of 1912, the Burnham family, a family of four, were found murdered with an axe in their home on Dale Street. When the news of the murders broke, neighbors had noticed that the Wayne family had not yet appeared with the rest of them. They, too, were found dead inside their home. Henry Blanche and their 18-month-old daughter, Lula, had been killed in the same way the Burnham family had, all on the same night. There was evidence that the killer in Villisca had also tried to commit a second murder in town, but had failed. A telephone operator had stated someone had tried to open her bedroom door around 2 a.m. that night, but thankfully, she had locked it. Next are the Monmouth Axe murders of 1911. On September 30th, William Dawson, his wife Charity, and their 13-year-old daughter were found bludgeoned to death by a heavy pipe while they slept in their beds. This crime scene had many striking similarities to the Villisca murders, with the biggest difference being the weapon used. A year later, we have the axe murders of Payola, Kansas. In 1912, only 6 days before the Villisca murders, Rollin Hudson and his wife were found dead in their beds, murdered by an axe. Their faces had been covered, the murder weapon left at the scene, the window shades had been drawn, and the doors were locked. And lastly is the Axeman of New Orleans. This was a series of murders that occurred in New Orleans between 1918 and 1919. Because the perpetrator was never identified, the man was attributed with the nickname the Axeman. This killer targeted victims inside their homes, attacking them with an axe or another heavy blunt object. The distance between the murders is great, but the brutal nature in the attacks, coupled with the fact that they all involved an axe, have led many to speculate that there may be a connection. In the early 20th century, the forensic technology available was lacking, more like non-existent. Even simple evidence collection, like fingerprints, was really not used at this time, especially in small towns like Villisca. So honestly, it's not really a surprise that an octuple murder case in a small town like this went unsolved. The shocking part is that it is still unsolved over a century later, and be one of the many cold cases like this that will forever remain unsolved and be a stain on American history. So now on to the house since the murders and the subsequent haunting. Since the Morehouse was built, it has had 13 different owners. That's a lot of owners for a house. In 1915, the home was purchased by J.H. Giesman. Over the next 90 years, the home had 7 other owners. Among them was the Villisca State Savings and Loan, which was probably a foreclosure. The house had a long period of vacancy until 1971, when the home was titled to Kendrick and Vance, and a month later, Darwin Kendrick was listed as the new owner. It's easy to assume that the couple was overwhelmed by the work needed in order to keep the house from being condemned, because it sat for so long, not being used, not being taken care of. So, he had reached out to a real estate agent about buying the home only a few months after purchasing it. Darwin Lynn purchased the home in 1994. Aside from being a real estate agent, he was also a historian. He was a part owner of the Olson Lynn Museum and intrigued by the home's history. Lynn bought the home for a cheap price. He and his wife, Martha, who was a fellow historian, worked to set up funds to restore the home to its original condition. Their hope was to bring renewed interest into the history that may somehow help Villisca heal its wounds and rebuild the town's economy, and it proved to be a very large task. The house underwent a number of changes. They removed the vinyl siding from the home. They repainted and restored the wooden floors. And let me tell you, as the owner of a home with wooden floors, that is no easy task.
Yeah.
It is a lot of work. The Lynns removed the home's functioning plumbing and electrical features. The front and back patio enclosures were removed. The outhouse was restored, along with the chicken coop in the backyard. The pantry that had been converted to an indoor bathroom was removed in order to turn the home back into what it was in June of 1912. Between old photos and interviews with neighbors, the Lynns had accomplished their goal of restoring the home back to its original state. The work that the Lynns had put into the home caused it to be added to the National Register of Historic Places. The home was also recognized by the prestigious Preservation at Its Best Award from the Iowa Historic Preservation Alliance. The Lynns then went on to open the home to the public for the first time in the late 1990s. They offered daytime hours and overnight stays. Not once in the years that they had owned the home did they advertise it, but their tours included a colorful narrative era, an overview of the murders, and the controversy that the town itself had found itself in. In the early 2000s, the Lynns closed the doors and had tried to actually rent the house out, but they found it to be extremely difficult because of the high amount of renters that had abandoned the house shortly after renting it. Some only staying in the house for a couple of weeks. In 2004, the garage was then removed to make room for a peg barn that was donated by an area farmer. And the finishing touches and walls were added in the summer of 2005. Darwin eventually finished the reservations to the cellar, an area of the house that at this point had largely been avoided. It was dark due to the lack of lighting, the stairs didn't exist, and most people met with bats that lived down there. Just let me tell you, no thank you, okay? No thanks. I had a bat attack my head one time. I'm good. You can keep them down there. I don't want them. Let me tell you, that was not a fun experience for me. Anyway. After Darwin's passing in 2011, Martha took over all operations of the house for the next 12 years. Later in 2023, Martha decided that it was time to retire and entered into a contract to sell the house to Lance Zeal, who is an entrepreneur and a Marine Corps veteran. He has a history of not only purchasing but also preserving historic homes all across America, and many of these homes are operated by none other than U.S. Ghost Adventures, L.A. The home was officially changed owners in January of this year. So, at this point, since the home was first built in 1900, it has had 14 different owners.
Jesus, that's
a lot. Yeah. There are also a lot of supernatural accounts associated with the house, which, that's why the house is popular. So we don't have time to recount all of them, because there are a ton. But I included the most common and most popular accounts. So the haunting didn't really seem to appear until the Lynns had opened the house to the public in 1998. Visitors had begun to report all kinds of unexplainable phenomena. Everything from feelings of dread to sounds like footsteps and kids laughing. Some visitors have recorded engagements with spirits on a two-way communication device, also known as a spirit box. One man had even experienced an inexplicable self-inflicted knife knife wound that he had no memory of. That would scare the shit out of me.
Most definitely.
Like, no thank you. So most visitors report feeling a sense of concentrated dread, profound sadness, or inexplicable rage upon entering the house. There are reports of a strange fog that seems to be moving from room to room. So, this fog just goes from one room to the next, to the next, to the next. If that's not paranormal, I don't know what that is. Ghost hunters have documented spirits with many types of electronical devices, including EMF and EVPs. Photos have captured orbs, the ghostly fog, and many kinds of other ghostly phenomena. Children have been observed playing with an unseen person under the bed in what is referred to as the dark room, which is actually the parlor bedroom where the Stillinger girls had slept the night of the murder. If my child starts playing with something under a bed that I can't see, I love you, but it's time to throw that whole damn child away. I love you, but it's return, please. I need an exchange. I walk into a bedroom and my child is playing with something under the bed that is not actually there. I might sign myself up to go into the nut house, okay? I'm good. So in 2014, one paranormal enthusiast had entered the home with a hunting knife, even after the home caretakers warned him against taking it inside. Let me tell you, this guy is clearly stupid, okay? And I'm about to tell you why. He's an idiot. After attempting to provoke the spirit into responding to him. Why would you go into a haunted house and try to provoke a spirit? You're an idiot. He reportedly saw a flash of light and then he woke up in the hospital. He had suffered a self-inflicted wound that he did not remember inflicting. He later returned to the house and apologized to the spirits for his behavior. That was probably smart. So, some have claimed to have made contact with the victims themselves, along with other victims, and even claimed to have made contact with the murderer. Many of those that have stayed the night say that the real thrill occurs around 2 a.m. when a train passes through the tiny sleepy town. It's believed that the train's whistle triggers the events of the murder. So, documents, movies, and books have all been written, produced, and released about the Villisca murders and the house itself. The house itself is now known as the Villisca Axe Murder House. It's open for tours and even overnight stays. You can find out this information at VilliscaIowa.com or MurderHouse.com. The house is infamous for being one of America's most haunted houses. So who wouldn't want to go take a peek and see if the rumors are true? I mean, I want to go so bad, but I can't find anybody that'll go with me. In Villisca, it's 2 hours from us. No. I want to go so bad.
I'll come up with Michael and we'll drop Michael and the kids off and be like, bye.
Hey, that works for me. I had some of my friends in high school went, and I didn't get to go for, you know why. I didn't get to go. So, they went up there and they had booked an overnight stay. They didn't stay all night. They ended up coming home early. They were freaked the fuck out. One of my friends in high school, her foster mom was she did crystals and spirits and cleanings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
They were so bad freaked out. She went out and saged their fucking car that they took. They were bad freaked out. They said that if you went into one of the kids' rooms, you could roll a ball. They rolled a ball across the floor and the ball rolled back.
Damn.
Yeah, I want to go so bad. So there's not much known about the murders. Obviously, it's all rumor. It's all speculation. And the Villisca house itself, well, the mystery alone draws you into it. The only thing that is truly known about the house that sits on 508 East 2nd Street is that it stands as a chilling symbol of the history, mystery, and the awe that lurks within it. And that is the final part to the Villisca axe murders and the haunting that followed. It was a sad one, but I thought it was kind of fun. Got a little bit of true crime, a little bit of spooky. Yep. Man, this is just, I really wish that they would solve this case. Like, no, it's not. But I, like, everybody wants the JonBenet Ramsey case to be solved, okay? That one is a mystery. Like, I feel like we all know what happened in that case, okay? I'm not going to say it on the recording because I don't want to get sued. But I feel like we all know who did that. It's just a matter of proving it.
Yeah.
But this one, this is the one that I want to know who did it. This is the one that I can't just, I need to know.
You're like, I got it.
Yes. I need to know so bad. Which that is one case I will never, we're never going to cover the JonBenet Ramsey case. That case has been covered so many times. I don't want to do that case. Literally every year this time of year. It's all over the news. Every podcast out there covers it every single year. It's been worn out, dadgummit. Anyway, do you have any final thoughts before we sign off now that I've went off on a tangent? We did have a really quick announcement. I completely forgot about it until just now. Monstrous is now officially an Audio Boom original. So you can find all of our information on audioboom.com. That can be found on our Facebook page. The link to that page it has everywhere that we're listed, everywhere that you can listen to us. It has links to other podcasts that Audio Boom has on their studio system. So check that out. That's very fun and exciting. We officially have a host site now. We're moving up in the world. All right. Well, that's it. We'll be back in 2 weeks for our next episode. I get an episode off. It'll be Ashley's turn. What, 22 episodes in and I finally get an episode off? That'll be really nice. So, as always, our sources can be found on our Facebook page, along with some of the photos I have that I'm going to post on there, some of the suspects, stuff like that. You can find that link in our episode description. Please make sure you give us a rate and a review. Don't forget to subscribe so you can get notifications when new episodes are released. So we hope you keep listening. And remember to...
watch the monsters.
And don't kill people. Bye, y'all.